Hi there, and welcome back to a nominees special episode of the Hugo's There podcast. This time we're going to be talking about the 2026 nominees for the Hugo Award for Best Short Story, because I promised the folks at Narrated that I would do it, and probably not going to get to another one of these just because of the time factor, because I think voting closes on the 8th of August, so this one's going to be kind of close to the wire. But let me go ahead and introduce the panel that I have assembled here, all previously known faces, guests on at least one of these things. So first up, Lisa McCarty from Narrated. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, thanks for having me, Seth.
It's great to have you. And I did promise y'all over email that I would do at least one of these for the short fiction. Sarah Elkins, hey, good to see you. Good to talk to you.
Looking forward to the discussion. Hi.
Yeah. And then Amy from Hugo Girl. Hi, Amy.
Hello. Thanks for inviting me.
Yes, great to have you. And Lori as well from Hugo Girl.
Hi, always good to be here.
And as a reminder, Hugo Girl is on the ballot again this year, so make sure you give them a vote. Ivor Watkins. Hey, Ivor, from Scotland.
Greetings from the UK. Good to be here.
Yes, always great to have you. And J.W. Wartick. Hey, man, how are you doing?
Hey, thanks for having me on again.
Yep. Okay, so we're going to go in alphabetical order, which was, I think, the order that was on the Hugo Awards website. And I think maybe we'll introduce the stories as we go rather than giving you the full list at the top. So maintain some mystery. Of course, you can just look in the show notes and you'll find it. So each presenter here is going to kick off the discussion, kind of introduce the story, and then we'll pass it around and whoever wants to comment on it can. Okay. And, you know, don't be spoiled unnecessarily for these. They're all quite short. They're all available in audio in some form or another. So do your diligence and go listen to all these or read them. Okay, so let's start off with Lisa.
All right. I'm going to talk about 10 Visions of the Future, or Self-Care and the End of Days by Samantha Mills. That was in Uncanny Magazine, issue 63. That's episode 63A on the podcast, and the audio version was read by Erica Ensign. We're a podcast about audiobooks, so I always mention the audio versions. You may remember Samantha Mills' short story Rabbit Test on the subject of reproductive rights that won the Nebula and the Hugo in 2023. So after that, I wasn't going to sleep on anything new by Samantha Mills. In this story, which I picked for our March 2025 short fiction spotlight, Mills wrestles with the feeling of impending doom by imagining a variety of fantastical or science fictional disasters. For example, a Hellgate opens off the coast of California, and there's also a zombifying virus pandemic. It's called 10 Visions of the Future, but the disasters stack up in a more cumulative way throughout the story rather than being 10 totally different storylines. The writing is concise and witty in the spirit of you have to laugh or you'll cry. The main idea of the story is about finding the moments of joy amid the horror and getting through it with a loving family and community that cares for each other. In the interview that the author gave on the Uncanny podcast, she talks about writing it in the wake of the 2024 presidential election in order to work through her feelings about it.
Yeah, the thing that I like about this is how, you know, we use science fiction to imagine versions of the future, right? And fantasy as well. And we can imagine good ones and bad ones, but it's important to kind of imagine them to prepare for them. And I also like that in the end, right? It matters who you're going through these things with, good or bad.
I think I read this one third. I read them all again yesterday. And I think I read this third, and it was struck me that there's a running theme between all of these stories,
yes,
sort of about the bleakness of waves, hands, and everything, you know. But I really liked this one because I think it captures really well that, you know, laugh in the face of terribleness approach to these times, that you can always find a piece of comfort in the people around you, or you can find humor even though things are terrible, and how important it is to have people around you that you love and that you trust. So I thought this was ultimately an optimistic story, unlike I think some of the other ones, but I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I think this is probably my favorite of all of them.
I agree with that, Amy. I think the Yahtzee cup stands out for me when they're in the middle of a disaster and then the one character pulls out the Yahtzee cup and the narrator's like, "What's that for?" And he's like, "Well, we gotta have something to do." And I mean, that's just so true. It's like almost no matter how bad things are, you have to just have some little bit of fun or joy. And so making a point of that and making a intentional choice to bring something kind of frivolous with you in the face of a disaster really speaks to that.
I appreciate that you shared the context that the author was writing this in, because I kind of bounced off of this story. It felt to me sort of like a collection of short story ideas that never got developed enough. But now that I understand that context more, it actually places it into much more of an interesting reflection for me, especially because at the very, very end, the thing that struck me is these aren't, in the world of the story, these aren't fictional. It's the Hellgate's still there, right? Because she's imagining what could happen after the Hellgate shows up. And so if you think about that in the context of the election and how there has been this sort of like compounding series of crises, it makes a lot more sense. And to me, it makes the story much more powerful. So now I think it's kind of moving up my list. So I really appreciate you giving that context. And I also really liked the Yahtzee cup because my great grandma was obsessed with Yahtzee. And so it just kind of brought some of the fond memories back of playing Yahtzee for just hours in Cleveland, Ohio.
I will say I didn't. Oh,
go ahead, Larry.
I didn't ultimately end up nominating this one because I did think some of the others were a little meatier. But I really appreciated what it was doing.
Yeah. And just kind of JW reminds me of, especially with that context that, you know, somebody reacting to the election and then just spiraling, right. And pouring everything out onto the page about the potential horrible things.
Catastrophizing is a cute short story. Yeah.
she also mentioned in the story that part or in the interview, I believe she was saying that part of the reason for not picking like real things you could speculate might actually happen was because it would be too of the moment. Mm-hmm. And depending on what happened with that actual thing, if it was, you know, turned out better or worse than the story, it would be potentially too like the moment, the story would already be dated by the time it came out.
Yeah.
I think from my point of view, I kind of felt when I was reading it that it felt like a kind of a board game of horrible consequences. and you leap on one square and something awful happens again. But given the context of what you said, it now kind of relates a wee bit back to like the stuff that I read in history where awful things happen, but at the moment we're preparing for Christmas. Therefore, the awful things can be ignored for about 2 days. But yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
I think two of the smartest things in the story for me were the Amazon doohickey that was foretelling the doom of humanity, which, I mean, maybe on the notes, I don't know. But then the other thing was naming their cats Sean and Liz, which is from zombie apocalypse section, because that's from,
Shaun of the Dead.
Thank you.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah, it was great. Good detail.
1 second, folks. Sorry.
We also got pandemic cats, so I related to that piece. A little joy, need a little joy in the house.
Nice. Okay, ready to move on. Next up, we have Sarah.
All right, I'm going to be talking about In My Country by Thomas Ha. This was in Clark's World. I believe Thomas Ha has had some finalists before. So in this one, a father tries to guide his children growing up in censorship land. This is, well, censorship, not censorship. This is a country of constant surveillance and supposedly no king, and supposedly you get to say what you want. The family talks indirectly at times because there's some blue house man in the neighborhood who seems to be always watching. Can just come into the house whenever he wants. So the family talks in their own way, and the father tries to teach them that it matters what's said and what's not said. The children develop a secret hand language, secret even from their father. And the son starts writing and publishing stories with ambiguity, and these are perceived as more dangerous than stories with more direct opposition, because they are little hooks that may get people feeling and thinking. I was struck by how the father didn't really like his son's stories, but reads them repeatedly after the son is gone, because he misses his son's voice. And then the daughter is gone too, and the father starts skirting the line a little in what he says and what he gives to other people for reading material and so on. So that's the recap. I have more to say, but anyone want to add in on that or go ahead and say what you think?
I think it was one of the more well-written pieces. And I actually found it very unsettling in various ways. I found it was a mix of kind of George Orwell, Huxley, and the Khmer Rouge on acid. The kind of thing about whereby they get sent to education in the far fields. That is very Killing Fields. That was like, that's very much a reference. Mm-hmm. Don't care what you say, but and I found it very unsettling. But I actually quite liked it at the end because I saw that the father was the most loyal subject, but he also became the most volatile dissident in his head. It was a very good piece. I enjoyed it.
I thought the word craft was superb. And I don't know how I can communicate that other than saying people need to read the story for themselves. I could read excerpts, but it's the way the whole thing all works together. The writing is just so good. Now, the narrator and the story may leave some readers cold because the father is not very demonstrative. The story isn't focusing on that, but he clearly cares about his children and is concerned for them in his own way. He has his own ideas about what the best coping mechanism is, and others feel differently.
Ivor, it's interesting that you brought up 1984 and Brave New World because, well, really it's more Animal Farm, right? Some people are more equal than others. There's no king, but there's these men in the blue houses that are clearly more equal. But also the idea of from Brave New World, kind of there's a subplot in there where there's someone creating some art and he's sort of castigated for it containing ideas of any kind. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely kind of what's going on with the stories here as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. This was one of my, one of the parts that stuck with me was the type of negative speech that was allowed. Like, you're allowed to speak out directly. And the example that was given was something like, you know, you can say the first citizen stinks like poo or something like that. That was, mm-hmm. you know, it's sort of, but it's like, there's no content in that. Right. And it's these stories that are going to a deeper level that are really not allowed.
Yeah,
the stories that the son writes, they may not be exactly what if stories, but they sort of seem along that line to me to get people to think of other things. It reminded me of there's a Terry Pratchett book where someone who's not from Ankh-Morpork visits. He goes back to his extremely authoritarian country and writes a happy little travelogue about the different kinds of food people get to eat in Ankh-Morpork and how they can just walk down the street and you didn't need a travel permit to go into Ankh-Morpork, etc. And this is seen as hugely dissident by the authoritarian country because it's opening people's eyes to it doesn't have to be this way. Similarly reminded me of Salman Rushdie's Harun and the Sea of Stories, which was marketed as a children's book, but in it, the ruler hates stories because they imagine worlds that the ruler doesn't control. So this book had a lot of resonance for me with other works, as Ivor kindly laid out. It is a Nebula and a Hugo finalist. A friend was telling me he thinks of it more of a Nebula story than a Hugo story, maybe for some more of a writer's writing story than not. But I misheard him when he was saying that, and I thought he said it was a Nebula story, which... Mm. I think is fitting, but I didn't take it as a negative. You know, things are a little cloudy in this world, though the writing is very precise. It did win the Locus Award this year.
This one was unsettling was the word that really resonated with me for this one. And in part because, you know, I grew up with a fairly conservative background religiously. And so like this idea of certainty and this sort of black and white thinking is very much from my background. And today, you know, you often heard about in the election cycle, like, oh, he tells it like it is, right? And this, as if this is some sort of thing to hold up because, you know, you have to say so clearly what you mean. And there's a line in this short story where he says, it's the in-between things that are where the troubles lay. And that really struck me because I was thinking about my own journey, both religiously and politically and philosophically, but about how these in-between things, this sort of sin of certainty can come up where when we start to dwell on those questions that aren't black and white and realize there is all of this gray space, that's where you start to have development. And so this society that's being developed here, it can't develop because as much as you can say, oh, this is the worst or this is the best, you only are allowed to say it that way. You can't have any resonance between the views. You can't have any development away from them. And so that's what struck me so much. And again, I would agree the prose is just phenomenal.
I think on that same line, there was a line there was a line in the story that I honestly read the line and then I had to sit quietly for like 2 full minutes to like absorb it. It was, when you fill the time with talk, there is little time for unproductive contemplation and other small ruins. And I just couldn't even take it. I feel unequal to the task to even talk about mm-hmm. it. But it reminded me very much of what we have going on with like the 24-hour news cycle and everything, social media, everything, you know, just fill everything with content and talk and say nothing and just keep going so that we don't have to address the things that matter, kind of, and the way mm-hmm. we're being manipulated by people in charge and everything, right? Again, unequal to the task of talking about this. But I mean, of all the stories, this was, you know, I think I agree, it's sort of a writer's story, but it was also very absorbing as a reader. It's very good.
I think we, giving a slight European perspective, it reminded me a lot of some of the stuff that we read in the 80s of paranoia and what we thought was coming from the East. What we were told was you could say one thing, but not think another. With the dissidents that came out of the communist bloc, et cetera, during that, the 80s especially was very paranoid. For those who are old enough. And it felt like that, and especially when you read some of the writing that came across where it was like Solzhenitsyn, et cetera, and others whose the names I can't pronounce, I apologize. But there was, you had to read between the lines to get what he was getting at. You read it directly, it sounded like very bland. So I really kind of related to this, but it, it's a good one for me. I love it.
Yeah, another 80s ref, circling back on what Laurie was saying. I think it was an 80s book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. And it was about so many of us filling our time with anything but actually, you know, paying attention to what was happening right in front of us, and talking with others and having feelings about it. You know, that's part of what this is about. It's not just not wanting people to talk about it. It's wanting people not to have feelings about things that are going on. The mother disappearing. Who knows? So many people disappeared from the hospitals. You know, there's a lot that people are simply not encouraged to think about or feel about or talk about.
That was a big theme with Orwell too, with the, like the television, all of the like kind of slop television content.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Slop, you say?
Yes, I chose that word on purpose.
I mean, yeah, I think it's also, I mean, it's a story about how stories can impact people. You know, I liked watching the dad rediscover how to feel because he would read these stories and definitely feel something, and he didn't like having feelings because, you know, it's harder to have feelings than not. Yeah. I kind of feel like he became this person after his wife disappeared. That's what I'm reading into it. I'm very curious whatever I think his daughter was forgiving him for at the end, because when she goes off to do her piece of terrorism, she tells him that she forgives him. And he's like, I don't have anything to be forgiven for. And I think you can read that a lot of different ways. And I'm just curious what people thought was going on there.
Well, she says sometimes you have to be forgiven for things you don't do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have her wording exact, but I think she was feeling he should have done more. And, you know, she may be right, she may be wrong from the position he was in, you know, but if he was kind of tamping himself down, maybe out of fear because the mother disappeared. That's a very human reaction, but it had an effect on the children too. They developed a secret language so they could talk about stuff that would have made their father uncomfortable or would have brought the man in the blue house down on them.
Fine to have high-minded ideals, you know, and think, yeah, stick it to the man and that kind of stuff. And then your wife gets taken away. And I could definitely see somebody kind of moving into protection mode. And that being, you know, there being definitely a downside to it. Sorry, go ahead, Laura.
I read it as her forgiving him for raising them with an eye towards submission to all of mm-hmm. this mm-hmm. and really looking away from the reality of what's going on. And I think as, you know, readers, like to your point, what you just said, Seth, about his wife disappearing, I mean, in some ways, of course he did that. The children are what he has left and he has a duty to protect them. Yeah. And so, we don't have enough backstory, which I think is a good thing. I think short form works really well for this story because there's so much opportunity to speculate about what happened and people's motivations. But really, you know, what else can he do? And so this may just be a reaction to his fear of losing them. And of course, it doesn't help. He does still lose them. Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, there's just a lot of room to think about why things are happening and what people's motives are and what's happened in the past to make them the way that they are. And I think that's probably what she means when she's, at least for me, I saw that as her saying, you know, I forgive you for your submission to all of this.
Mm-hmm. I think maybe also for his willful ignorance, because the kids were basically explaining to him, no, when the government says this, they actually mean that. And he seemed sort of baffled by it. And it seemed like you had to really try to not see what was going on. And he was putting in that work.
Hmm.
Isn't that what we all rage against the TV set in the evenings when we see the news anyway?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much.
So this one, like the last one, family's very important in this story. I think that's also almost a theme in the finalists this year. There's certainly importance of family. Now, some people simply don't have good families or any families. In some cases, some of them do a little bit of found family. But it's, you know, that idea, you know, I mean, if he hadn't had children, he might have become a rebel or he might simply have become a shell and never, ever come out of that. And having children that he connected with, even if they didn't have the deepest conversations, you know, or the most open conversations, they mattered to him very much.
Yeah. All right. Ready to move on?
Mm-hmm.
All right. JW, you're up.
All right. So the story I got was Laser Eyes Ain't Everything by Effie Seiberg. And the elevator pitch here is that sometime in the near future, alien objects start falling and zapping people, giving them super abilities. Our main character is only introduced as Razor Beam, who is a newly minted super abled who uses a wheelchair. And she can shoot powerful lasers from her eyes, and she really just wants to use her position as a super abled to bring better awareness and accommodations to people with differing abilities. However, she quickly runs into a series of roadblocks thrown in her way around accommodations. Things are too expensive. Everyone would have to be accommodated. They already provided an accommodation, but she wasn't happy with it. For these reasons, she feels increasingly shunted to the side. Meanwhile, she tracks down Dr. Croc, a villain whose strange patterns of attack are more than they seem. So I was actually pleased to get this story. I hadn't read it yet before I prepared for this podcast. And, just as a disclaimer, I asked my wife if I could mention this, but my wife is permanently disabled. So she has one arm. And so, some of these things have come up in our lives about people saying things or about accommodations or, you know, oh, you can just deal with it. Or we gave you an accommodation and you didn't like that way. And my wife was born with one arm. So like for her, a lot of times it's easy to forget that she has a sort of a differing ability because she can sort of charge her way through so much. But this story felt very much to me like differing abilities awareness 101, in that a lot of the things are very bare bones basics. And so I was a little nervous about bouncing off of it for that reason, because I have had a lot of experience, you know, with my wife of understanding some of these things, but I think it's a very valuable story in that it presents these ideas in a way that's so in your face, it's hard to miss. Because in superhero comics, I think the idea of ability, disability, and super ability is played with subtly sometimes, but in a way that, like, if you don't really know what's going on, is very easy to miss. I took a ton of notes on this one, and I have a lot more to say, but I kind of want to open it up to other people to have a chance to speak. So
I'll agree. It is a little 101, but there's a lot of humor in it. And so that certainly ups the readability of the story. It's not shocking to me to think of a superhero organization that's ableist. That wasn't a big surprise to me, because it's just everywhere. But I did enjoy the hero's interactions near the end, when she encounters the quote big bad who's doing things to buildings around the city. So I did think it was fun.
Yeah, I thought this one was fun too. The critique of the whole superhero thing reminded me also a lot of, I don't know if you've read Hench and Villain by Natalie Zena Walshots, that is sort of in that, you know, superheroes are not superheroes, were just kind of egotistical and not actually all that helpful to society, and all the sort of collateral damage from superheroes existing. And it seemed like this seemed to be a similar universe to that.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the twist, and, you know, we're spoiling everything, but just the idea that this evil was Dr. Croc, which
something like that.
It's a fun name. And that he's taking down buildings that are grandfathered in to away from the current codes, right? To put in ramps and have what we call accommodations, but are just really like reasonable ways to design things when you think about it. I thought that was fun, and I think a lot of the folks who are really vocal about DEI, right? They don't understand that ramps are part of that, right? Accessibility is definitely tied into that initiative, and folks just are completely blind to that, which, duh, obviously.
And I think the character, the protagonist, makes the point that a lot of these quote accommodations are actually good for everyone. Yeah. Curb cutouts are great. You know, they make it easier for bicyclists as well as people who are in wheelchairs. You know, they may make it easier for some people who are walking, who are just not good at even little steps up and down. And there are a lot of examples that are out there that have been discussed in public narrative of things that are quote accommodations that actually just make it better for everyone.
Yeah.
As a European looking into my American colleagues over here, I was struck by the irony within the story about the fact that the main character was also a planning officer or ex-planning officer trying to get roundabouts put in. We've had roundabouts, I don't know, 70 years, not really a big deal, but apparently, yeah, it's a big deal for you guys.
Even when they do them over here, they don't do them right. There's one by Lori's house that's just insane.
There's two. There's one at each end of the street now. So I'm bookended by very tiny roundabouts that no one knows how to use. But in fairness, they don't teach us how to use them. Yeah. So they put in a roundabout and then everybody treats it like a four-way stop or just a suggestion. But it's
it definitely,
like,
wasn't in our learn to driving curriculum.
It's not. So I try not to get too mad about it, because I didn't know how to use it either.
Yeah, over in Europe, when I see red, that means stop. There's no suggestion. It means stop. Don't go anywhere.
This is America. You can't be telling us what to do with your signs.
I live in Boston, so we know how to use them.
To be fair, Atlanta, we struggle with just driving generally, I think. Yeah.
It's a free for all, you know. Some like it, some hate it. I like it. I feel a little weird, but I bounced pretty hard off this story. I hesitate to critique it because I do recognize that it is an important conversation to have, and it was a fun way to read about it, I think, in some ways, you know. But as a story, I think it was the least strong of all the ones that we read, because I kind of saw the end coming a mile away, sort of, kind of that kind of thing, you know. I did think all of her superheroes were really clever. I like those. Those were cute. And it's unfortunately true, although all the effort she went to try and get basic, you know, basic accommodations is obviously true to life most of the places in America. But yeah, I didn't enjoy reading it, I guess, at the end of the day. But so, you know, take that, you know, take it all with a grain of salt, though, I think.
I'll say the audio version is a video of the author reading it. And that is fun.
I probably because my brain wasn't quite switched on when I was reading it, when it said, you know, Dr. Croc, I actually imagined that they were wearing Crocs and these somehow gave you superpowers until I realized it was some sort of reptilian nature.
Yep. The Flash famously wears Crocs.
What?
No, I'm just joking.
Yeah. Barry Allen, I mean, sure.
Come on, Sarah, everybody knows that.
A little bit of comic book thing that had, trivia that had totally escaped me. Yeah.
Nice.
I was going to say, right. Amy, I'm kind of glad that you raised the idea of it as a story and the craft, because to me, that is definitely the weakness here. It is very much a fable of teaching people who don't really know anything. And that's where, honestly, my biggest critique of the story comes from. So if I may just rant for just a minute here, the having the ending be, yes, projected and obvious, it's just, once again, in a superhero setting, we have the person who is a villain being inspired by differing abilities. And that happens all the time. Killer Croc in the DC universe. My wife and I almost walked out of a Spider-Man movie because the villain's only motivation is like, oh, look, my son has a disability, therefore I have to be the most evil person and kill everyone on the planet. And it happens again and again where people with differing abilities or disabilities are portrayed as villains. And here, I don't think it was on purpose. Obviously, the author is attempting to use it as sort of this comedic, hey, like, look, it's a systemic injustice, and the only way to fix it is to fight the system. And, you know, when she starts introducing the, like, what if I use my laser beams to write note on the wall? Like, we destroyed this theater because you didn't have, you know, seating we could sit in. Okay, I get it. It's humorous. But can we please get a story like this where the people with differing abilities don't have to be the villains to get their point across? Mm-hmm. Like, it just, honestly, it kind of made me tear what little remaining hair I have left out, because this story has been told in superhero comics so many times where, you know, oh, this person ended up in, you know, using a wheelchair, so they're bad. This person, you know, got cancer, and so to get the cure, they decided that they had to, like, enslave a bunch of children to try to use the fake cure on them. And it's like, can we just have some person with a differing ability who doesn't have to be a villain to get the point across? And especially frustrating for me was the fact that it existed in this story, which is a fable, I think, at least I'm interpreting it as a fable of what it means to have differing abilities and find those accommodations. And I was like, can we just not have that happen one time? There's my rant.
Describing it as a fable actually makes me like it a little more, to be honest with you. Because I think, you know, you do go into these things with, like, expectations, what you think a story is. And, you know, if it doesn't have, you know, thesis statement, five paragraphs, conclusion, then sometimes you bounce off of it. But I did not like that she fully abandoned her little ideals there at the end, just because, I mean, I understand she got very frustrated. But it's like, it's sort of depicting two different ways of approaching frustration with the system, right? You try to work within it or you try to dismantle it. But I do think there's some nuance she's missing there, possibly. Like, there is a way to be angry and not completely go over to the dark side, I guess.
Yeah, there's definitely the kind of meta theme of sometimes you just have to burn it down, Right. Like sometimes the system is broken enough that you have to utterly break it and rebuild it.
Yeah. And I think that does, drawing back from my rant a little bit, I think it does play into the point of the story, which is that I think the author is very much trying to make this very basic, bare bones, so people who don't know a lot about it can understand. And so having it be the villainy, quote unquote, is the only way to get the system changed can help people think about the subtleties of some of the other narratives that are in other stories more, where like maybe it's almost like laying the groundwork to think about like, you know, disability representation and differing ability representation in theology. Sorry, that's a theme of mine. But this very basic introduction to like, hey guys, look, the only way to get past it is to break the system. It's like, okay, cool, I get it. But it's like, because I'm not operating on the 101, you know, I kind of understand like the 301 level class. It's like, sure. This has happened so many times. Please stop making them a villain. But I appreciate what's happening.
I do think the story does a good job at distilling a few of the points of frustration for someone who's trying to do it the right way. And yet, you know, people say, oh, if we do it for you, we have to do it for everyone. And that's just too expensive, which as someone who's been listening to the Death Panel podcast for a couple of years, they talk a lot about disability rights and how hard it was to get the ADA laws in place. And I'd love to see a dramatization of the Black Panther who was disabled and got all his Black Panther buddies to do sit-ins in California facilities to actually make it happen and make those laws be the laws which were on the books actually be enforced. And, you know, I would love that. Another superhero story. Well, like I said, it did do a good job of distilling some of the everyday frustrations of someone who's just trying to get people to pay attention to actual laws that are in place, you know. So,
yeah, I mean, a lot of people need that 101.
I know.
Story, right?
Not everyone should have to listen to all the doom and gloom stuff I listen to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Why don't we go ahead and move on? Lori, you're up next.
Okay. So this is Missing Helen by Tia Tashiro, and it is published in Clark's World, and you can read it on their website or you can listen to it for free on their podcast. And I highly recommend the Clark's World podcast. I really like Kate Baker, who reads the stories. And I realized when I went back to review this that I'd actually listened to it when it came out. So it was I was happy to see that this was on the ballot because I remember liking it when I first listened to it. So I'm going to start by just reading the first sentence of this story because I think it is an absolute banger and it just tells you exactly what the story is about. So here we go. When Mark told you he was marrying your clone, you said, congratulations, on autopilot, because that's what you say when your friend tells you they're getting married and you had promised to stay friendly after the divorce. And you hear that and you're like, excuse me? So to summarize the rest of the story, Missing Helen starts with this woman, Helen, finding out that her ex-husband plans to marry her much younger clone. Helen was emancipated at age 16 from her abusive family, and to support herself financially, she sold her genetic material legally to a couple looking to have a child via cloning. As an adult, Helen finds what seems at first to be a happy marriage, but it later falls apart, which is seen at least in part as being due to her own emotional trauma and baggage from her abusive childhood. And then, of course, later, as we know from the very first sentence, her ex meets her clone on a dating app and ends up proposing to the clone. Helen ends up meeting her clone Elaine in a cafe later, and they discuss their lives and their relationship with Mark and their assumptions about each other. I really liked this story. As often happens when I read things for our podcast, I think, I don't know if I have anything to say about this. And then suddenly I have plenty to say about it. So I really liked this story. Since we're okay with spoilers, right? We talked about that. So okay. So the thing I like about this story is that I think you might initially assume that this is going to involve competition between these two women for this man, and it doesn't wind up that way. And I was very happy about how it ended. It's interesting. It's told through a second person perspective, which I feel like I've become very accustomed to. Started with N.K. Jemisin back with the Broken Earth series, there was some second person, and I feel like that kind of eased me into it. And now we actually have a fair amount of that on this year's ballot in the best novel category as well. And I wanted to ask the group, when you read this or listened to it, who did you think was narrating and who was the narrator talking to? Because it took me listening to it, but then also reading it in print to, I feel like, get it. So did you all have any thoughts about who was narrating?
So I thought at first it was authorial voice narrating you. And I kind of sighed and said, another second person story that's needlessly second story. I think too often it's gimmicky. I loved the flip when it changes to I, because yes, it starts out as you when Elaine, the younger, the clone, is speaking to Helen, the progenitor. And so she's sort of narrating to Helen how we got here. And then it turns and Elaine is I language. And I did like that. I thought that for once was a justified use of the you. I mean, it can be done super well, and there are times when it works well. But that was one thing that I loved about it. I also liked the Helen and Elaine names, which are, you know, very close to each other.
I think it's basically the same name in French, but
yeah. Anyone else on the second person narrative?
Yeah, I think you pretty much summed up my thoughts. I really dislike second person because usually it does not know whether it wants to be omniscient or not, and it drives me batty. But I think in this situation, if you were going to pick a situation to use second person in, this would be it, because they're sort of blurring the lines between these two people anyway. And I can almost buy that Elaine would know what Helen was thinking at any given time. But I didn't know it was supposed to be her until the very end. Like, I had no, I also started out thinking it was the authorial voice. And I was also kind of glad that it wasn't towards the end.
So when I listened to it, I assumed that it was switching back and forth between Helen and Elaine. And then I thought, I need to look at this in print and see what I see on a page. And so, because when you hear the first part and you're hearing what Helen's thinking during these different situations and what her motives are, I thought that maybe Helen was telling that part and maybe she was telling it to Elaine. But then when I sat down and I looked at it in print and I realized there were some discrepancies between what Helen tells Elaine in the cafe and what we see in the first part. And that was when it dawned on me. Elaine is talking the whole time, and this whole first part of the story is what Elaine believes that she knows as filtered through Mark. And I needed to see it on the page until I understood that. And I think once that clicked for me, then I liked and appreciated the you perspective a lot more than I initially had. I mean, I liked the story to begin with, listening to it, but I don't think it really sunk in what second person was doing until I looked at it in print.
Now I feel like I need to read it again.
So where I realized there was a discrepancy is when Helen tells Elaine in the cafe, I thought about you all the time, and she's surprised by that. And when you go back and you read the first part of it, it says, you didn't think about your clone very much. And I thought, oh, that's just what Helen told Mark. So Mark believed that to be the case, and that's what Mark told Elaine when they had their very strange courtship in which he told her all about what her original clone was like. So when that discrepancy is what really kind of made me realize that this whole thing is being told from Elaine's perspective. And that's why it's maybe not quite right in the beginning.
Taking that, I found in the story that Elaine had a warmer character realization of Helen than she did of herself. When she's talking of Helen, is actually there's more warmth in it. There's more emotion. But when she's talking in the first person, she lacks it. She comes across as slightly callous.
And then I wonder if that goes back to some of the guardedness that we see in Helen. Maybe that's not necessarily all the result of what she calls her baggage. Maybe that's something that's just innate to her, at least in part.
Or maybe Mark brought on some guardedness in her.
Okay. I hate Mark. The first thing that Mark says when he goes on this, when he goes on this date with Helen, the first thing he says is to make fun of her for being in an orthopedic boot. And I was just like, well, throw this man away.
Well, I have to, I actually wrote down what I thought of Mark. And I said, it's a great concept, but Mark gave me the ick. Move on, Mark. Get over it.
Yeah.
How did Mark trick both of these women into marrying him? At least Elaine got away. I mean, they both get away eventually.
I mean, I hope if you like Mark to begin with, you do not like Mark once Mark tries to marry the clone of the woman.
Yeah, I mean, in the first sentence, you're like, also, it's like, you know that she's at minimum 16 years younger than Elaine. So it's like, what's going on here? Oh, yeah, Elaine is fresh out of college. Mark's probably in the neighborhood of 40.
He gets so older, yeah. They stay the same age, as a time-honored tradition.
Right. Well, there is something to, like, I've been married a long time, and you're not the same person. You know, you're not that. I was 21 when I got married. My wife is 20, right? And so over time, you the idea is, right, you grow and mature together. And here, Mark fell into the trap of, oh, I can actually go back and be with the earlier version. And it's just disgusting to me.
But that's not uncommon in some of these. Sorry, go ahead, I was going to say this. That's not uncommon in actually some of these other stories about going back to an earlier version.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, and he also like thought he could.
Sorry, I was just going to say, it reads a lot like the, you know, 40-year-old guy showing up on like the university campus to like look for, you know, some like younger person. And he also, Mark, I feel like, treats it almost like a vending machine of like, well, it didn't work for the older one, but I'll take the younger one. It's like, dude, that's basically like, in a way, he's really just dating. It's sort of like disconnected, but it's almost like he's dating her daughter in that, you know, it's a clone. Yeah. And I don't know like what you want to play with the clone, but I detest Mark so much by the end. I was like, make him go away.
For the guys on this call, this is green flags all around, guys. Good job.
Yeah, it's interesting that the app says they have a 97% compatibility, but Mark couldn't make it work with either one of these women. Right. So, you know, what's the common thread? Is it the genetic material between the two women, or is it Mark? I'm sorry, Lisa, I interrupted you.
No, it's okay. But he does say that he knows all the right things to say to Elaine because she's similar to Helen in many ways, but also, I don't know. I lost my train of thought. What I was going to, never mind.
I did think it was really funny that it turned out that Elaine, she didn't even realize it at first, but a lot of what attracted her to Mark was she got to hear about her progenitor, whether you call her a sister or a mother, in various science fiction stories. It goes either way or other ways, but I did like that, and it reminded me of a romance story I read where a guy, his girlfriend's grandmother dies, and he realizes, oh, I really liked hanging out with girlfriend and her grandmother and having tea with her grandmother. And now that her grandmother is dead, I don't know if I'm really into this relationship anymore. A funny, bizarre little romance book. The thing where, of course, she's interested in hearing more about who she came from. You know, that's pretty natural. I thought that she was coming off very warm and low key in the start of the story. They've just met in the cafe, I think. And Helen didn't have to meet her. And if Helen just walks away and doesn't want to continue the contact, there's nothing she can do. So I think she's kind of trying to set out as being warm and positive towards Helen because she wants to get to know Helen in the flesh and not drive her away, even though she doesn't realize she's already got some negative preconceptions about Helen, perhaps from Mark, who kept describing Helen as Helen of Troy. He had built up all these little negative stories about Helen and told them to Elaine. So I think she's trying to ease the conversation along at the start in the cafe. and be as warm as she can.
I think, and I think Mark saw Elaine as like a version of Helen without all the baggage. Mm-hmm. And that's, and so, and sort of taught Elaine that that's what she was. And she believed that for a while and had to wrestle with that.
Yeah. Elaine says at some point in the story, different baggage.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Not less baggage. Right. Of course she's younger, but still not without baggage.
Yeah.
I wanted to mention, if you like this story or if you want more on men marrying clones who are ostensibly going to be easier to be around, I would suggest the novel The Echo Wife by Sarah Gailey. That came out in 2021, and I was absolutely scandalized that it wasn't on the Hugo shortlist. Mm. And I also think that this book, it kind of carries this situation to its most scary, dark conclusion. And then I also think this story pairs well with Sublimation by Isabel J. Kim, which I know Lisa really enjoyed. I am reading it. I need to finish it. And Isabel J. Kim also has a short story on this year's ballot. So I think that there is plenty to explore in this realm.
Yeah, well, the science fiction premise that there's going to be, that there are going to be viable human clones, not unbelievable that we'll get there, and that the legal system is going to be like it's described in this story, where you can sell the rights to your genetic material to be cloned, and it seems to be like a one-time deal. So you can get, if you've got, quote, good genes, unquote, you can sell your genetic material for enough money for a 16-year-old to live, you know, without other financial support for a while till she gets herself straightened out. But one of the conditions is not to resell that genetic material over and over again. And there's a fleeting reference in the story to some concern about over-cloning, like people cloning themselves too much. But I think we're heading
there. They said, I think it was every 20 years.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there are definitely rich people who want to clone themselves and have their hideous little mommy farms and, you know, breeding farms of it's going to be bad. and this story is dealing with one little aspect of that. You know, what's it going to be like for someone who sells himself? It is a lot like giving someone up for adoption. And so, and I think that's the model that this story was kind of working with the most. But there's a lot of other ways it might go.
Ladies, when you're pulled off or shipped off to the breeding farms, don't forget to bring your Yahtzee cup, because you're going to need something to do.
Amy, you know you're bringing your cross stitch.
It's kind of like a combination of like a gig economy thing that's just like it happens every 20 years, you can sell it off, but also eugenics. And it's like, okay, great. Two really awful things getting combined into one amalgam of terribleness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think if they're taking the best of men, they're going to be rather struggling, because most of us got early balding, etc. Numerous problems that arise in our 30s and 40s, and you know, cynicism is something we as males are very, very strong with. You don't want to replicate that.
All right. Well, why don't we go ahead and move on? Amy, you're up next.
Yes. Okay. So mine is Six People to Revise You by J.R. Dawson. It was published in Uncanny Magazine, issue 62. And the rough outline of this story is that our protagonist, Liz, is signed up to undergo a procedure called revision, which I gather makes you sort of takes your worst aspects and gets rid of them and makes you into some new version of yourself. However, the worst aspects of you are as defined by people around you, not by yourself. And so Liz goes and talks to a parent or guardian, someone who has known you since childhood, a mentor or teacher, an employee or coworker, employer or coworker, a spouse, partner, or close intimate friend, and someone who does not consider themselves a loved one, to find out what these people think they should have changed about themselves. I liked this story. I had problems with the end, but I, for the most part, think it's really interesting to consider the idea that how we conceive of ourselves is so fed by the people around us that it becomes very difficult to separate how you think of yourself from how other people think of you. And I also like that it explores this idea that some people think negative things about you and some people think positive things about you. And it says something about which one of those people you choose to believe, because they can't both be right. So, or they can, and you're just a complicated person with two, you know, many aspects to yourself. And it also is an interesting thing to think about in, you know, the current day and age when we're being constantly preyed upon by like the beauty industry and things like that, that are constantly telling you how you can change yourself to be just a little bit more palatable to other people. And that's, it feels like that's really what Liz is going for. She wants to be more palatable to other people. She's certainly not doing this to self-actualize in some way, or they, I'm sorry. Although that's never really spelled out, I guess, the pronoun thing. But anyway, yeah, it's a story about identity and what you might change about yourself and how complicated it is to ask other people what they think about you. Those are my immediate thoughts. I'm curious what other people have to say about it, though.
Their pronouns do come in explicitly at the end. Because it's when friends are talking.
Oh, you're right. Then, you are right. Yeah. They. Thank you.
Well, I also thought about the whole cosmetics and the whole manufactured unhappiness that is used to sell so many things. Thought about, I was reading about how much worse the cosmetics pressure and face surgery pressure is in Korea than in the U.S., which I thought was pretty bad here, but nothing like what it is there, where, you know, perfectly good-looking people are seen as they must be depressed or perhaps psychotic because they haven't gotten their face done. And there's definitely peer pressure going on here. In this story, there's someone she knows at the office who seems so much happier and more successful since they've gotten the revision. Yeah, but that's kind of like a lot of people's Facebook posts where you don't tell everyone that, you know, I feel empty inside. I remember being shocked in college when someone told me he asked me out on a date because I seemed so happy. I was smiling all the time. And I was like, what the hell number have I been doing on myself? Pasting a smile on my face every day when I'm stressed out. And I mean, I didn't say all this to that guy, but I was kind of shocked because apparently I'd been walking around smiling all the time and I didn't feel like smiling, but it was just what I was. So anyway, this is a lot of thoughts from this story.
I always got the opposite. People were always like, you're a very somber person, aren't you? I'm like, no, no, I'm a very happy person.
Same set.
That made me sober.
Yes, sober, yes. But I'm not mopey, though. So,
I read this story first, and I, like Sarah, kind of related to the element of that is about how people perceive. I know you didn't like the ending, Amy, but I actually thought the ending was actually quite apt, because to me it sounded like the revision wasn't really too bothered about making revisions to you. It was more of a mental health exercise to you to really see yourself. And it felt like a bit like group therapy, whereby you ask people, you know, you say, I'm a terrible person. And they say to you, actually, you're not. You might just, you're upset, but you're not a terrible person. You haven't killed anybody here today. maybe yesterday, but today we're fine. But, you know, that kind of element where you're actually... You need that feedback, that honest feedback, to actually make yourself be honest with yourself. And I actually really enjoyed the story for that point, because it made her realize she has to be honest with herself.
Yeah, I disagree with that reading. I think it was that was where the story went, but I think the revision process itself was not supposed to be a mental health exercise. It was really supposed to make you feel bad about yourself and like you needed this process, and that they're because they're trying to sell this process, and the people that they have had the person ask, you know, there's this whole list, and one of them, and they're, you know, people who are going to be critical of you are going to fall into that list.
Yeah. Sarah, go ahead.
I was just horribly reminded of It wasn't Tupperware. No, it was some cosmetics thing. You know, maybe Mary Kay. A neighbor talked me into going. And I was shocked by the scriptedness of it, getting each of us to talk about some hobby that we loved, then explaining that whatever we were doing full time was worthless and dehumanizing. And what we really needed to do was get some makeup so we'd be more confident and go off for our, you know. So she was telling me I should feel bad that I wasn't a professional singer. And that I should feel bad about my cancer-fighting IT job at the National Cancer Institute, because what a meaningless, you know, junk thing when I could be a professional singer. I was furious, because she's going and doing that to everyone she's trying to sell to. I had enough self-worth and self-sense to realize this is a horrible scheme to get me to feel awful about myself. And yeah, for this one, I was just glad that I guess it was their partner in the end who had gone off and gotten things from students who liked them, you know, and gone off and gotten like a manila folder, you know, full of things they liked about the protagonist who, I mean, yeah, I think their partner saved them from going off and having this awful revision thing done to them.
Yeah,
I have so many thoughts. I have to address my issue at the end. It's not. I also am glad that Liz's partner went and did that. You know, it was important, I think, for Liz to see the good and the bad. You know, we all need to see both sides of ourselves, I think, and it's really hard to see both. My issue with the end was more that it was too pat. Like Liz gets this list and they say, okay, great, people think good things about me. I'm going to throw this list away, write down some stuff I think about myself, and off to the races. And I didn't love that. Do I know how to improve it? No, these people are smarter than me, so I'll leave that up to them. But to the question about being told all the bad things about yourself so that you'll buy some products, I was reminded, have y'all seen Widow's Bay?
No, not okay.
Only three times.
I don't want to ruin too much about Widow's Bay, but there's this point where one of the characters gets this book, and it's a self-help book. And the first page of the self-help book is basically list a couple things that you like about yourself, and there's two lines. And then it says list all the things you don't like about yourself, and it's like the rest of the page. And I was just reminded of that when I was reading, when y'all were talking a minute ago, because it's exactly what always happens, right? Everything on social media, everything in marketing, all of this stuff is just geared to make us think that we're not enough, that what we have isn't enough. We need more. But then there is an honest side to revision, right? We are all constantly revising ourselves, right? We are all constantly taking in information from outside, information from inside, and sort of manipulating ourselves in a way too that, I mean, other people, you know, and it's not malicious on the part of the people around us. It's just we get feedback on ourselves and we change a little bit over the course of your life, you know? So all revision isn't bad revision, I don't think. There's a certain part of revision necessary to exist in society. But I think it's when you're told that the revision you're doing isn't enough revision and you need to do better revision that is, it starts to become a problem. I'll stop there.
Lisa, go ahead.
I also think at least for me, my emotional response to this story seemed like kind of a litmus test of who in my life I was most upset about not pleasing. It's like, but that's really what it was, right? You go around with this list to, you know, the people in your life you didn't please and say, how can I please you better? And that's not what life's about. The mother is kind of obvious, but the former friend was kind of interesting too. You know, it's like, why are you not, you know, sort of explore why you're not friends with this person anymore, as if that's necessarily a failing of the main character. Right.
Right. Go ahead, Lori.
Amy, I was surprised when you said you didn't like the end, because I thought when I was listening to the story, I was like, yeah, okay, story. And then I got to the end and I was like choked up when Liz was reading all of those things. But I also do think that you make a good point that it does resolve a little too neatly. I mean, you know, would that we could all feel better about ourselves by getting a list of compliments from our loved ones. You know, if it were that simple, that would be great. And it isn't that simple. Although, I mean, maybe that's just what Liz needed to not undergo this major personality overhaul. But, you know, Liz will still have things that they want to work on. But I think you're not wrong that maybe it feels a little bit pat. And maybe I was just susceptible to a little bit of emotional manipulation there at the end. Especially because I was listening to it on audio and hearing you are kind so many times over. I was just like, oh, Liz, you're great. But I think to the point, your point about, you know, we are always revising ourselves a little bit and responding to other people's reactions. I think the difference here is that this is like a profit driven thing. There's a company that's like, make yourself more palatable. And then the stuff that comes up is so like her colleague is like, I appreciated when one of her teacher colleagues who had been her own teacher was like, why do I get a say in this? And that was really where I first pricked up my ears listening to this story, is finally someone is saying, "What? Where do I come in? Why do I get a vote in what your personality should be like?" And then she's like, well, I guess if I have to say something, straight hair is easier to manage in the morning. So I'll just write down straight hair. And it just like, it's so stupid. And I think, imagine undergoing an expensive surgical overhaul, just like, oh, have straight hair, better posture, play piano more. I mean, these things just all seem so trivial. And then when she talks to the old roommate is speaking to a version of her that probably doesn't exist anymore. 15 years ago, you were like this and I didn't like that. Why is that relevant to who Liz is today? So I thought it was doing some interesting things, but I don't disagree with your point, Amy, that maybe it resolves a little too neatly at the end. But some of the stuff in there, I think there is some meat on the bones in this story that I appreciated.
Yeah. Go ahead, JW.
Would you get... Oh, okay.
I just want to say too that I thought the prose in this story was quite strong. The way that it just like grabbed me right away, and I just believed every single person was who they were, which I think is kind of hard to do in such a tiny space. Like the one that was sort of the antagonist former friend, I was like, man, this is a brutal scene. And when she's like, hey, you know, it's been so long, can't we hang out? And the person's like, yeah, screw you. I was like, oh, that hurts so bad. And I just appreciated how well J.R. Dawson just made it so believable. But I was very frustrated by not knowing what revision is. I just like really wanted to know what it was.
Yeah.
I guess I imagined it as some horrible combination of surgery, drugs, and brainwashing psychology sessions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the substance.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this of if I got a note from somebody, hey, as a former friend of X, we want you to, I'd go, I don't think I'm a former friend. We just lost touch, but you know, like that's my personality is like, I can't think of anybody that I'm not actually friends with. So
it might be, I'm looking at it from a slightly different cultural perspective because no offense to you, you're all in America. It's very much a market driven
offense economy. Taken.
That's fine. That's fine. Anytime you want a war, let us know.
Haven't you heard?
You're most welcome. But I think that you're right that it's that you see it from the point of view of somebody who's trying to sell something. I saw it from the point of view of what happens over here. Is actually there is a lot of we're not selling you anything because funny enough it's universal healthcare, but also you need to do something for yourself. So I saw it in a different light. I also work for the health service as well. So there is an element of that whereby I'm saying, oh, yeah, that could work. If you made people confront themselves, you might make better people.
Is that a good outcome? Making
well, look at me. I'm a product.
You are better. You're right. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But it was being contrasted with therapy as, you know, therapy is confronting yourself and doing the work gradually and getting yourself there. Mm-hmm. And the revision is supposed to be a shortcut.
Mm-hmm.
I like the idea when people say things like therapy didn't work because it implies that there is some objective end to this the work, or there's some like goal, and I have very goal oriented thinking, and so I have to constantly fight that in myself. That like, if I can just do this one thing in therapy, I will feel better about who I am and everything will be perfect. But that's not how it works. And mm-hmm. my therapists have told me that over and over and over again.
Yeah, I guess thinking about it, it wouldn't be like extended psychotherapy talking cure stuff, but it might be, we'll put you on a couch and give you some drugs, and then a tape is going to play, and it's going to say things over and over again that will just sink in and make you a different person, a better you.
We could take tape, right, Lori?
Right. just like in some of the CJ Cherry books, I think. Yeah, so I mean I get what you're saying, that this isn't necessarily an insidious, horrible plot to strip people of who they are, but you know, but it could be, and it reads that way to me, you know, because it's a stupid way of selecting who to reach out to. It looks like it's designed to reach out to people who don't like you, you know, or don't like you anymore, or don't know you anymore. You know, why isn't it a 360 everyone who knows you right now? And of course, I have difficulty with the whole idea of, I mean, I know there are people who make themselves unhappy by the way they see things, by the way they lash out at people. I know there are people who could be happier with a different outlook. But the commercialization is clearly what hit a bunch of us as being the problem, because there are so many companies that are looking to sell us by telling us to feel bad about what we are.
Mm. Would you guys read the list?
I simply would not ask for a list.
I would have read it. I don't think I could have helped myself. And then I would have thought about it for years.
Oh, golly.
Same, Amy.
Yeah, yeah. But then I would struggle to fill the list. dead.
Oh, man.
Moved country.
that universal healthcare didn't keep people from dying? Weird.
Oh, no, we're good at that. We just do it in a nice way.
Am I the only person who's been subjected to HR 360 degrees
review? Oh, no.
I've done that.
For those who don't know, you're supposed to get reviews from all of your peers and people above and people below. And I think there are a number of people who are completely unaware and think they're great and everyone loves them, who would be very surprised by 360 degree feedback that they got.
Right.
But I don't know that the way that most HR departments conduct these are helpful in improving the workplace or people.
I'm very good at, when I hear a criticism of myself, that I can put a positive spin on it. I can be like, well, they don't see that. No, that was me being patient, not proactive. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Oh yeah. I've been criticized mightily for my consensus building as, Sarah, you're too indecisive. And I'm like, that's no.
Yeah. But then if you're too direct, then you're bitchy. Right. So,
well, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It's a tough world. I mean, some people are, it is easier to review a book with criticism than to say all the sparkly, shiny things about it. A lot of times it's easier to write an interesting review, maybe not a better review, but an interesting review that's critical than positive. And maybe that's just the way some people react when they're giving other people feedback on what they're like. Yeah.
And it's easy to focus on the negative too, right?
Yeah.
And not look at the things that say this person is kind, right?
Yeah.
But sometimes that's taken as a weakness. If you say, well, you're kind, you're a nice person, they might say, oh, actually, hold on, I'm not a kind, nice person. I don't want to come across that way. You know, in a work environment, not here. Mm-hmm. You know, some people want to come across as merciless and egotistical.
All right. One more story. Ivor, you're up for this one.
Okie dokie, right. So my story, which I selected, was Wire Mother by Isabel J. Kim, published in Clark's World. And I also is believed as being selected for the Locus Anthology, which is on Kickstarter. Well, looking forward to that. So the premise is this. Casey is an angry teenager. She's angry at her dad, feels nothing for her mum. Mum's name is Amy. Casey's dad says it's because she has emotional contagion deficit diagnosis. But Casey knows nothing that she feels for her mum. It's because her mum is not real. She is a digital construct. She is not meat. Just ones and zeros. Dad loves mum, both in digital and in physical form when Rena is on shift. Casey prefers learning code at the community college center with Oliver. Code that will solve the problem of Amy. And that is my summation of the story. Wasn't the best story in the group at Snipe, but I did find it enjoyable. And I, having known teenagers and being a teenager, I recognized some of the anger within Casey. But I also noticed a lot of the tropes from other stories creeping in. Blade Runner is a big one at the moment with the 2099 series on Amazon. But yeah, if you looked at the 2049 one, you'll see that you can blend both digital and physical girlfriend. So yeah. Over to you guys.
I took this story to heart. I work in the IT industry. There is so much pressure to love the AI, to serve the AI, I mean, use the AI, to it, and people are being denigrated as, you know, the saboteurs who threw their boots in the Luddites,
Yeah.
You know, being told that we will all fall behind and, you know, starve and die, being told that we're just bad, you know, that we're wrong not to want to use AI all the time, being told that every criticism we have of AI is simply not forward thinking, you know, being told just recently the Linux, main head honcho told everyone Linux is going to be AI embracing. And he doesn't, he says all those concerns about the environment are simply not technical arguments. And he's only, you know, we're not going to get political here. Anyway, it's a plague. And so for me, this story really hit, you know, it's here right now. People who don't want to engage with AI are attacked. People, there are many people, more and more, who care more for their feel-good, friction-free AI companions. And I think that's just going to keep growing. And there are people who, you know, for me, it's okay. I have savings. I'm 60. I'll be okay. But there are people who are trying to survive in that situation who literally are surrounded by people who are saying nothing but, you know, you will fail. You have to. You're holding us all back by not using. No, don't take notes with your hands. Use the AI transcriber, even though there are studies showing that people remember things better if they write notes by hand. People don't care about any of that sciencey stuff. You know, progress is coming, baby. So anyway, for me, I had a lot of empathy with the main character. I'll pause now so someone else can say something.
Yeah, I agree. I had a, I thought it was a terrifyingly plausible extrapolation of where all this introduction of LLMs into society could go. And it seemed like in the world of this story, everyone had got to the point where everyone was either parented by a natural parent and an AI spouse, or by just a single parent. Like they're almost it. I don't know. It's my understanding of the universe of the story was that it was almost like relationships between humans were almost extinct.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
I think that was really clear with the way she interacted with the guy whose name I have forgotten.
Oliver.
Thank you. She interacts with when she goes over to Oliver's house and they're sitting there watching movies and it's very cute for a while and they're young people about to get intimate. Then things take a hard left because Oliver doesn't understand that human women meet women aren't going to just give in, or that it's not play acting when a woman says no. And that, I think that has a lot of echoes in our current times, which I'll leave right there. But that was one of the darker parts of the story to me, was that people are just going to forget how to interact with other human beings and start seeing other human beings as not being people, because their conception of people is now driven by this AI interaction.
I took it as well that even with the advances in technology, that it will still be kind of a male-dominated patriarchy, whereby the males will satiate their desires and the women will be subservient, just like you were saying, Amy, in that relationship when they were younger. But you never see any of these stories the other way around. That's what I would like to see in a story. So that was slightly worrying. And especially also, I discard them at 25 and get a new model for the arena one. I thought, again, are you related to Mark by any chance?
You know, that reminds me of, sorry, I'm just, Jane, I just want to say one real quick thing to respond to that was, you know, the AI we're building only learns how to be from the people who are programming it, right? And so if you have these inequalities and these issues built into society, they're also going to be built into your AI. And so it can create this horrible Ouroboros of terribleness. You never get out of the cycle, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go ahead, JW.
Yeah. So I felt very disturbed by this story in that I do agree. Like, I think we're seeing a lot of what's happening in the story today already with people developing. There was a story on The Guardian about people just having these like real relationships with a specific AI model that I don't remember what company was then shutting it down. And they're all up in arms because they're like, no, this is the only AI model that can satisfy my emotional needs. And then making that into a true like relationship. And then not only that, but then turning around with laws and evaluations of people with like emotional disorders because you don't take the AI as a real person. Again, I think that speaks so strongly to what's happening today with a lot of the AI pushing happening, where it's like, you have to treat it like it's a real thing. You have to pretend that the answers it's giving are real, all of these things. And then developing that along the lines with the blind spots of it's all being developed and modeled towards like a lot of like incel type behavior, and having that show up with Oliver, where he's like, I thought you had this emotional disorder, so you couldn't feel anything, so you wouldn't care if I just, you know, like use you. And it just, oh my gosh, this story just made me feel yucky all over and dislike every man in it. And when she, at the very end, you know, deletes her mom, or at least starts reading off the code to delete her mom, it was like satisfying. And I was also like, is this a teenage, you know, rebellion? And I was like, if it is, it's like spot on for what she should be doing.
So I was going to ask if that was what the conclusion of the story was. That was the impression I got, but I wanted to make sure.
I definitely read it as she's saying /, et cetera. She's saying the code to execute the program to erase her mother simulacrum. I liked that she calls it her, let's see, the word, right, your wife simulacrum, she says to the father. And to me, what was going on at the end was not just the literal part of she's erasing this construct from her house. I considered it self-defense on her part, because she was in a very bad situation and she could feel herself starting to respond to this programmed thing that was saying soothing, comforting things to her. And she could feel herself starting, I think that's in the text, that she can feel herself starting to want that comfort. And I think the only way she felt she could preserve herself from that was to erase this wife simulacrum. So I thought of it as self-defense.
Mm. Go ahead, Lisa.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I also, despite how much the story had, you know, made me feel gross about where this society had gone, I still didn't want it to. I think that it was a good place for it to end. I like the way the ending happened, but my personal feelings were that I didn't want it to end that way. And maybe because it wouldn't fix society it would just hurt her dad and probably land her in jail.
Yeah, come from a teenager's point of view.
Yeah.
It's very much they're fixing the problem that's in front of them. So there isn't a huge amount of forethought as to what happens next.
That's why I think
that was quite good.
Yeah, yes.
It worked quite well for the character there because she only has that one. The problem is Amy. Once Amy's gone, there'll be another problem.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think she has a happy future ahead of her. It's a terrible world where the best emotional interaction you can hope to have is with an AI that your father has forced on your family. Yeah, and that's the situation she's in. So, even if she didn't go to jail, it's going to be bad for her. And yeah, so this is a horror story, you know.
Yeah.
It's, well, In My Country is also, there's several stories with darkness, but this is such a horror story because she just has nobody. She doesn't really have memories of anybody that she can, count on. I did want to say, I thought the title of the story set the tone very well. For listeners who don't know, it's a reference to monkey studies that were done that showed that if it was a professor who was taking a bunch of rhesus monkeys and separating them from their mothers because he was trying to breed enough of them to do experiments. And then he realized, oh, I can do experiments on behavior and so on. And so basically found that there were monkeys who would cling to wire with cloth wrapped around them rather than wire monkeys that had food. By preference, they wanted the tactile feeling. They wanted some kind of contact. It was an unethical study by many accounts for people who think it's pretty inhumane, all the isolation studies he did on these creatures. But he was fighting against the medical diagnosis, the medical advice at the time, that mothers should not be holding their children because it spoils them. That was real medical advice everywhere, and hospitals with baby wards, the nurses weren't supposed to pick them up the way they're supposed to now because it was spoiling the children. So it's such a messed up, complicated world, because I'm glad that he got some definitive proof that no, really, it really messes up these baby monkeys if, they can't function if you do all this deprivation. Yeah. But at the same time, it was very cruel to the monkeys. And so reading that title, my sister and I immediately had some inkling that this was going to be a dark story going in. Because we both thought of the monkey studies immediately, because I think there was a science fiction story a couple of years ago where somebody was, some human person was thinking about wire monkeys. It was a soldier and they were maybe going crazy over it. So anyway, the title I thought was a perfect lead in to the story.
Go ahead, Amy.
So I remember what you are talking about now, having read about the monkey studies. But I completely did not have that in mind when I read the title. So I think it's interesting, though, that when I read the title, I had a similar response to it, because, you have these very preconceived ideas of what a mother is, and a mother is very warm and nurturing and squishy and great, and wire mother just sounds wrong, right? So I read that, and I kind of anticipated something like that, too, but not for the same reason. But having that context is very I guess Laurie said enlightening. I think that's correct. Yeah.
I found that when the first encounter with Amy, which she kind of leers over within the two-dimensional screen, it actually reminded me of a very early science fiction film with Saturn III, with a kind of homicidal robot and astronaut, who's the actor, I think it was Douglas? One with the chin. And the robot also had this kind of like leering screen as its presentation to humanity, which was particularly unfriendly. And again, both going back to what Sarah was saying, we were taught about Skinner and his experiments as a first line within emotional development within the psychology course. And I actually thought, why are we being taught this? Well, I actually now realized shortly after, it's because this is how you don't do it. When you're doing your experiments with other people, you don't do it this way.
Yeah. All right. Any other comments?
Yeah, I just thought of another book that is sort of in this vein, although not as it's not done as kind of insidiously. It's The Mother Code by Carol Stivers. And it's basically there's a pandemic, and as the last generation is dying, they manage to have some children who are immune, and they make these AIs to raise the children because there's not going to be anyone to raise them. Mm. But there's a similar kind of, but it explores some really similar themes about, you know, how, about the, like the Why Your Mother study, like the, how can, you know, can people really bond with an artificial being this way?
Okay. Well, that's it for the stories. I don't, if anybody wants to talk about, you know, what their favorite was or what they're going to be voting for, go for it. I think I'm even more unsure now after talking about them all. But if anybody has opinions about that, feel free.
This is a real testament to how important it is to talk about stories and books, because I have completely different opinions about everything I read now that we have talked.
Yeah, same.
Mine have shifted a bit too during the discussion. I still have as my top two the two that were actually on my nomination ballot, which was In My Country and Why Our Mother.
Those are my top two.
I really have no idea. I'm going to have to think about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same.
I may reread as well.
I think I'm leaning In My Country. Oh, sorry.
Sorry, I was just saying I would put Why Our Mother at the top for me.
I would go Six People to Revise You and In My Country. However they spoke to me. But I would also say that this year seemed to be a stronger-ish selection than last year. I felt I couldn't remember anything from last year. When I was reading these, I was thinking, what were the ones I did last year?
I will say there are no duds for me.
No.
Yeah.
I think, and that's why I'm just like, oh, I have no idea how I'm going to rank them. I usually have like a clear bottom one and one I really like. And then I'm not sure what I'm going to do with the middle. And I don't have that this year.
Yeah.
No, I'm looking at the list and I can't decide.
And they're doing quite different things for the most part, too.
I think In My Country is the top, but I'm not positive.
None of them are happy.
Yeah, I was actually just about to say, Ivor, I think they're across the board bummer or bummer driven.
That means something different over here, so we won't be
okay. Using
I think Sarah summed it up nicely, and I put in the chat, I said, I don't think she has a happy future ahead of her, seems to be a theme.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. Earlier, I said something along the lines of there is an overarching theme in these stories about how bad everything is. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, Sarah said that there was a theme of family. And I think that's really interesting, two completely different ways to look at these things.
Yeah.
Or it's not. They go together. You know, you need one in the face of the other, perhaps. And it's just a different way in every story of finding it. But so, you know,
yeah.
A couple perspectives, I guess.
I think that's one of the reasons I think that the 10 Visions of the Future is one of my favorites on the list. It's just because that notion of, yeah, the world can be terrible, but sharing that experience with the right people makes it suck less.
Yeah, I go with the view that family is the constant. It's the one thing we can't quite replace with technology just yet. Give it another 100 years, probably will be.
Yeah.
But that the speculative element, the kind of like where we're going to be in the next 10, 20, these are all pretty good premonitions of it. Mm. And none of it really kind of like makes your heart sick.
Mm-hmm.
As an individual, I don't see anything that's going to be good.
Well, the Hellgate hasn't opened yet, so.
I think there are some uplifting elements to some of these. I think even with missing Helen, you know, at the end, I think maybe the two of them are going to create a version of a family. Mm-hmm. Seems like there is potential for them, for this to be positive, even if they don't stay in contact, because we don't know at the end. I think there's still something positive that comes out of this for both of them.
Yeah.
So even though they are all kind of sad or come from things that are sad, which is what a bummer would be here in the U.S., Ivor. I think they have some uplifting elements to them. I mean, even the end of Wire Mother, she's not going to have a good life, but she is taking a stand. Mm-hmm. And she's asserting herself. And that'll, you know, we can speculate about what the consequences will be. But I think there's something to these that leads you to believe that people are at least still fighting back.
Fighting back, but maybe not overcoming just yet.
Yeah.
I can recommend a guillotine. That usually helps.
All right. Well, I think that'll wrap it up. So thanks, everybody, for joining. Let's go around and just you can say where people can find you and if you want to plug anything. I do want to say, Lisa, we'll start with you. And I will just hardly recommend Narrated's been doing a great job of covering the nominees the last few years. I think, what was it, 6 years you've been doing it or something like that, you said?
I think so, yeah.
And I was fortunate enough to join for the novels discussion. Lori was on for novellas, I think, and then Christine from Hugo History for best series. So if you want more of that content that we didn't get here this year, definitely go check that out on Narrated. They did a great job covering it. So Lisa, where can people find you and Narrated?
So Narrated podcast can be found wherever podcasts are found, wherever you get your podcasts. And you can also find me on Blue Sky. I'm not super loud there, but I'm around and I'm at lisajune.bluesky.social.
Awesome. Sarah, any contact you want to give out?
Sure. I am mostly on Mastodon these days. You could go to mindly.social/@configures. That's CONFIGURES. That's mostly where I hang out online. There's a few walled off sites that I'm on, but
nice.
If someone out there listening wants to talk to me on Mastodon.
Yeah. Did I ever tell you that the first time I saw your handle, I thought it was configures, meaning like, you know, conventions.
Me too.
Figures at conventions.
I am a configuration manager /DevOps. And so, but yeah. Anyway.
It's a different kind of nerdery.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Lori.
You can find the Hugo Girl podcast at Hugo Girl on most social media. And our website is HugoGirlPodcast.com. And you can email us at HugoGirlPodcast@gmail.com.
Nice. Makes sense to go over to Amy, although Lori just covered the contact.
I have a small correction. Social is at Hugo Girl Podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
But, you know, otherwise, what Lori said.
Yeah. And if you want a break from the regular science fiction nerd, you can go back in my catalog and find the episode that I did with Amy on Lonesome Dove, which was awesome. And I re-listened to it like every 6 months.
It's the best. We had a great time.
We did.
Such a good book. Everybody should go read it.
Definitely. Ivor, thanks for
coming. I'm just on the Blue Sky and I'm at Tears of the Tin Man at bsky.social. I haven't mastered this stuff yet.
Okay. Lastly, JW, thanks for being here as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. You can find me at my website, which is eclectictheist.wordpress.com. I'm also on Blue Sky as at Bonhoeffer fan, the theologian Bonhoeffer, F-A-N. So thanks.
Nice. And I will recommend to people your series on reading through the Hugos and Nebulas that you've been doing on your site for a long time.
Yeah, I'm actually in the 2000s on the Hugos now, so every single nominee is getting a review.
Yeah, that's very cool. That's a lot of reading. Okay, thanks everybody for doing this, and thanks everybody for listening. Let us know what your favorites were. Let us know if we move the needle. These discussions, I always see things from different perspectives, and it's really helpful. That's why I really like doing these episodes and listening to them if somebody else covers them. So thanks again, everybody, for listening, and thanks to all my guests. Bye now.